Being an astronaut is synonymous in our culture with being a hero, and there are a few that are household names like John Glenn or Neil Armstrong, but perhaps none of them had as much of an impact on our society and NASA itself as America's first woman in space, Sally Ride. Find out her story. It's all new and all blue next. After her 1983 flight on the Space Shuttle Challenger, Sally Ride became one of the most famous people in the world, and yet she was also an intensely private person, her sexual orientation only becoming widely known after her death in 2012. Former ABC News reporter Lynn Scherr covered the space program during the early Space Shuttle era and became good friends with Ride. Her biography, Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space, is an in-depth look at the astronaut, scientist, and human being. Lynn joins us via Skype. Lynn Scherr, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Let's start with your first encounter with Sally Ride. What do you recall about that first meeting?
Well, it was my first time at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and in 1981, I had been invited to join our ABC News team of really ace people. We had Frank Reynolds, who would be anchoring, and Jules Bergman was the science correspondent, and both of them had a lot of experience covering space and covering NASA. I had never covered it, but I was brought onto the team as a third person because ABC really wanted to make a big splash with the first space shuttle and the rest of them. So I was sent down to the Johnson Space Center to do some interviews before the scheduled April launch of STS-1, the first space shuttle. And one of my assignments was to do a piece on the so-called new breed of astronauts. That is the individuals who are scientists and not necessarily fighter pilots or military people, which is what NASA had mostly done in the past. NASA offered up a couple of different individuals, one of whom was Sally Ride. And, of course, her class was the very first group of women, six women, that were eligible to be astronauts. So I think we had two women, I think Ron McNair, African-American. We did have one fighter pilot and somebody else. And the minute I met her, we just clicked and bonded and became friends immediately. She was serious but funny. She was witty. And she acknowledged that without the women's movement, there would be no women in the astronaut corps at that point. She was very grateful for that. And she spoke in a very plain, direct, and smart way that I really liked. So I did my story, and we became friends for all that time since.
So she was quite an athlete, and she had an accomplished teen tennis career and met many lifelong friends on that circuit, didn't she?
Sally Ride could have been a professional tennis player. She elected not to be because she figured out while she was on the circuit, and she was very, very good on the junior circuit, and then she thought she'd give it a shot. Billie Jean King was one of her mentors, and she realized or decided that while she knew she was good, she was never going to be at the top of the heap, that she wouldn't be number one. And Sally never wanted to do anything where she wasn't number one. So she decided that's it for tennis and went off to Stanford and started studying astrophysics.
I think her life path was strongly influenced by that love of physics. Is that fair to say? You know, that's kind of what pushed her in the direction she finally went?
There's no question that she loved science and loved physics. And ultimately, it became astrophysics. And when people would tease her who knew nothing about astrophysics, and they would say, "What is astrophysics?" One of them, the mom of one of her girlfriends, said, "What's astrophysics?" And Sally would say, "It's about space. Period. End of sentence." Sally didn't think she wanted to be an astronaut because in those days, women couldn't be astronauts. She had watched Neil Armstrong land on the moon and Buzz Aldrin. She had followed the space program. She loved it a lot, but it never occurred to her that this was something she could do. But astrophysics, let me go back a bit. Physics was a way to order the world. Astrophysics was a way to order the world and then go beyond this world. And I think both of those things enormously appealed to her. And yes, indeed, ultimately shaped her professional life.
And she got eventually a PhD and became Dr. Sally Ride.
She got two PhDs, if I'm not mistaken. She got a master's, she got a PhD, she was full of degrees and fully intended to be teaching and doing research. That is the life she saw for herself. I used to tease her much further along after she had flown. I used to tease her that she would be happiest in the stacks of a library. I don't know if anybody knows what stacks and libraries are anymore, but I think she really loved that. She liked quiet contemplation. She liked working on her own research, and everything that came afterwards went with the territory, but that's not why she did it.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio, and we are talking to Lynn Scherr, former ABC News correspondent and author of the biography Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. How did the possibility of becoming an astronaut land on Sally's radar?
Well, it actually literally landed on her lap I think it was January of 1977. She woke up early to go to one of her classes at Stanford, where she was a graduate student. She was actually just finishing her PhD thesis. And she went into the student union to get a cup of coffee to wake up and a sweet roll. And she picked up a copy of the Stanford Daily, which is the student newspaper. And there above the fold was the article that said NASA was looking for women and minorities to apply to be astronauts. Sally read the article, immediately left the student union, went and got a piece of paper and an envelope and a stamp, it was that long ago, and immediately sent off for an application. She said to herself, I can do that. And with that, one of the extraordinary things about Sally is that she was a great decision maker, and she could make a decision quickly. And with that, she reads this article, she's up, she's out of there. With that, her entire life changed, because she knew that even though she had always said, I want to do research, I want to go be a professor, this is my life, I like academia, suddenly here was this new possibility, and she knew it was for her, and she knew she could do it.
And of course, famously, she was selected for that first flight for a woman in the American space program, STS-7 Challenger, in June 1983. I really enjoyed the account she shared that you share in the book of what liftoff is like, the feeling of that loss of control under those tremendous forces being unharnessed and unleashed as all that explosives is, you know, in a controlled release below you. I was wondering, there's something about that that also is telling about her as a person, that she had to kind of give up that control for a moment, that life was out of her control. It was in the control of the rocket and these natural forces. What was that story like when you got access to her to talk about that first flight?
You know, you've touched on something very important. And the truth is, Sally didn't like to lose control of anything. She was your basic type A personality. And yet what happened to her is she was a terrific team player. And I think that came from her years of tennis. I really do. I also believe that her tennis experience and traveling on the circuit and winning and losing and winning again was something that really appealed to the NASA board that selected her as one of the astronaut candidates. And for Sally to be able to give up control at that moment of, as you say, the controlled extraordinary energy that lifts the shuttle or any rocket or any vehicle off the launch pad, what it meant was she had to really trust the people she was working with and the machine she was traveling in. And she was a great question asker. Sally could have been a great reporter. She could have been a terrific trial attorney. She knew exactly what questions to ask. And she had satisfied herself that these were the safest vehicles possible, that everybody was doing their best. She was a terrific member of a crew. She flew with the same commander twice, Bob Crippen. And people loved traveling with her and working with her. And I think for her, it was very empirical. The data were there. She knew exactly how everything worked. She, of course, was a mission specialist. She was not the pilot. She was not the commander. She didn't fly the shuttle. But guess what? She could have, because she knew how everything worked. So giving up control at that moment was indeed something new for her, but she did it because she knew she could trust the people she was with.
And you just reminded me of another little tidbit briefly I'd like to share, where she kind of filled in for Bob Crippen in that role in a training mode.
Yeah, during one of the, in the simulator, he had to be away. He was training for a second mission, if I'm not mistaken, and Sally had to act as the commander, and she pulled it off. You know, if you'd ever met her, she was little. I mean, 5'5" or something like that, and very slim. Not tiny, not miniature, but she was a kind of a little person, and yet she projected enormous authority, and Crip trusted her, and the crew members trusted her, and she trusted them back, and that's how it worked.
Now, during that time, she was married to a fellow astronaut. Tell us about A2, Steve Hawley.
Oh, A squared, actually.
A squared.
A squared, right. Steve Hawley came to NASA while he was doing graduate work in astronomy. He's an astronomer, and he is an extremely funny, witty, smart person. And I love the story, which I later heard from everybody, that at the first go round, when this class of new guys, the 35 new guys who were this new class that Sally was part of, first time ever there had been so many non-military personnel, they all stood up and identified themselves. And so somebody would stand up and say, I'm so-and-so, and I was an attack pilot with the Navy in Vietnam. And somebody else would say, I'm so-and-so, I was an attack pilot, whatever. Steve Hawley stood up and said, I'm Steve Hawley, and I'm an attack astronomer. Uh-huh. And that became his little nickname, the attack astronomer. So Sally called him A squared. I have subsequently learned that it wasn't just attack astronomer. It's because he was astronomer astronaut. That's what the A squared was about. Oh. But the attack part of it works as well.
I personally got to know Eileen Hawley, his later wife, as a liaison with the press. And right. She was wonderful to work with.
Oh, Eileen Hawley is terrific. They're both very good friends of mine still. They live in Lawrence, Kansas, and Steve is teaching at KU, and they're living a good life, and they're wonderful people.
Yeah, she's great. Now, let's talk about Tam O'Shaughnessy. When does she become a significant part of Sally's life?
Sally and Tam knew each other from the time they were little girls on the tennis circuit. And they were just pals like everybody else. And they played tennis together and against each other and did all that stuff. And it was after the Challenger explosion, and it was while Sally was married to Steve, that the friendship with Tam, which had continued, turned into something else. Tam was one of the people who'd been at the launch. Sally had invited a number of her tennis girlfriends to come to the launch, along with a lot of family members. And, you know, that may have been the start of something. It's not clear exactly when the moment was. But the friendship changed, and they realized that they meant a lot more to each other than just girlhood tennis pals. And Sally then found herself in the uncomfortable position of being in love with one person and being in a marriage with another. So she got herself out of the marriage. She did not tell Steve why. He only found out much later. But Sally made the decision, and she made the decision not to be public about this. It was her choice. This was in the 1980s. It was a different period. And I believe from all the research that I did, and I talk about this a lot in the book, that she did it to protect NASA, that having become the first American woman to fly in space and ultimately to fly twice, she didn't want to saddle future female astronauts with the kind of inquisition that she knew would come about if it came out publicly that Sally was a lesbian. And she decided this was her business, hers and Tam's, and nobody else needed to know about it.
If she were in the same position at that age today in 2017, do you think she would have to have that be the case?
I think there is no way it would have to be the case. I think NASA took a little bit longer than a lot of other institutions and agencies to come around to the 20th century. But once they did, they were there and they are there. And I think that the future is quite bright for anybody who wants to be an astronaut and be whatever they want to be, whether it's about sexuality or color or gender or anything. I think the future of the space program has a lot more problems than sexuality at this point. And so I just don't think that's going to be an issue. I think it was largely generational. I think it was about the military mentality. But given that our military has changed so much, I have no doubt that NASA would be just fine. And of course, you know, Sally is the first known gay person to have flown, but who's to say that there haven't been others who have flown and just felt that they also had to keep it quiet?
Sure. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Lynn Scherr about her biography of Sally Ride. We're back, and you're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. Let's continue our visit with Lynn Scherr, the former ABC News correspondent and author of Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. Sally was pivotally involved after her flight career in the investigations of the two space shuttle tragedies, the loss of Challenger in January of 1986 and Columbia in February of 2003. And she, one of the things I found fascinating about your book, she really played a pivotal role in those investigations. I'm especially interested in how she became the conduit for figuring out what happened to Challenger.
Well, let me just say, overall, you're quite right. She was not only a dogged investigator who did her homework, who didn't stop asking questions, who wanted to know why these things had happened and how to prevent them from ever happening again. But there's a little subterfuge in there. In terms of Challenger, she was handed, apparently, a piece of paper with some data that indicated that NASA, or at least the Marshall Space Flight Center, or somebody knew that the O-rings, which were those rubber, big rubber gaskets that kept the solid rocket boosters from leaking, that the O-rings could not function below a certain temperature. And that's because those figures were on this piece of paper that someone handed to her with numbers that indicated below a certain temperature, the O-rings simply were no good. Sally got this very damning evidence and also understood that if she were to present it at the Rogers Commission, the Challenger Commission hearings, that somebody might figure out who had given it to her, and she didn't want to get that person in trouble. So she slipped it to another member of the commission, General Coutina, Don Coutina from the Air Force, and he wound up somehow getting it to Richard Feynman, the great physicist, who was the one who brought it up in the meeting. So it was like three times removed. And it worked, and Sally's fingerprints were not on it. And only after her death did I learn this story and was able to report on it now.
And it was, of course, Feynman who did the famous demonstration with the O-ring, the rubber in cold water, ice water, showing it shrinking. It kind of made it apparent to everybody watching, this is what happens.
Right. And I was in the audience, of course, as a reporter covering the hearings that day in Washington, and there was an audible gasp when he did that. Mm-hmm. It was so simple. And this, of course, is what Feynman was known for, was making very complicated things very simple. And all of a sudden, the world figured it out.
And of course, she had to repeat that performance of being on another investigation with Columbia in 2003.
And yet again, she handed something off to a reporter who reported that there had been some tests done and that it looked as if, had NASA known about the problem with the tiles, which ultimately caused Columbia to break apart when it re-entered Earth's atmosphere, but had they known about it, there is a chance, it wasn't 100%, but there was a chance that another shuttle could have gotten up there and there could have been a transfer of the crew to the safe vehicle. It didn't happen because NASA didn't investigate at the time, didn't explore, didn't want to look to see because they thought nothing could be done. Sally knew this could happen, that there was the possibility of escape, and passed the information to a reporter who told me about it for the first time, and it's also in the book.
Well, after that, you know, her life after NASA is what I'd like to get into now briefly. She could have been a physics professor at Stanford, but for some reason wound up at UCSD, and I found that to be fascinating.
Well, the problem is she couldn't be a physics professor at Stanford because they wouldn't take her. It's really quite shocking that here was this graduate of Stanford, first American woman in space with a stellar record, and they didn't take her. You know why? Because she hadn't published anything. It was so absurd. And of course, the Nobelist, Sidney Drell, almost resigned in protest. He was quite annoyed about the whole situation because he wanted her there. But Sally, in true form, she was such a great pivoter. She got an offer from UCSD, University of California at San Diego, turned, went down south, and never looked back, and was happy as a little clam at UCSD. So it was Stanford's loss and the loss of all the students who were there, but the young people and the research people at UCSD got to have her, which is great.
And she really seems to have found her stride there at UCSD. I, as a professor of physics, I so wished I could have taken a class from her.
I wanted to take her class too. She taught a number of classes, one of which I totally forget now what the formal name of it was, but she called it Physics for Poets. And it was a way of explaining physics to lay people. And I used to threaten that I was going to fly out and just sit in on a few of the classes. And darn it, I never did. I wish I had.
Well, after teaching, she went into business, sort of. Can you tell us about Sally Ride Science?
Sally was determined that little girls should all have the same opportunities that she had. She did research and she learned that, of course, little girls and little boys are all born with the same curiosity and the same whatever their intelligence is going to be. But at about the age of six or so, little girls suddenly get socialized away from wanting to be in science and from wanting to do things that have always in the past been thought of as boy things. And she was determined this was not going to happen again. And she started a company with a couple of friends and Tam called Sally Ride Science, the sole purpose of which was and is to teach teachers how to deal with little girls and little boys who express an interest in science. She was determined that science was going to get its due and that all those sort of offhanded comments like, why are you studying such a hard subject when you could be studying French or English? That nobody would say that again to these children. Nothing wrong with French or English. I was a Greek major myself. But she wanted kids who cared about science not to be sidetracked. And that's what Sally Ride Science was founded for.
When was the last time you saw her?
You know, I was trying to remember that today, and probably a year or two before she died. Whenever I would get to San Diego, I would call her if I was working on a story, and we would usually get together. She would be in touch when she was in New York, but it had been at least a year or two since I'd seen her, and certainly, well, she got diagnosed the year before, so certainly in that period. And like everybody else, I regret not having just, you know, beaten down her door so that I could have seen her one last time.
Yes. And one of the most difficult parts for me as a reader was reading the end of her life story, because she really did approach that in a kind of a scientific way.
Well, you know, a lot of people now these days write their own, produce their own funerals, so to speak, or their own memorial services. And Sally was ahead of the curve on that. She knew what she wanted. I think Tam was endlessly grateful that Sally helped her map it out. And she felt that talking about a memorial service, a celebratory service rather than a funeral and a dirge, that talking about that when Sally was at the end actually cheered Sally up, because she liked being involved and she liked doing something. And the service was 100% Sally, all organized by Tam, of course, with wonderful speakers, people that Sally really cared about. And her touch was there, and she was still there in a lot of ways.
What about her legacy, especially the STEM program that she began, you know, with science, technology, mathematics, engineering? The Sally Ride Science program, is that still going?
It's still going. There's lots of stuff still happening. And there's another piece of it that I know she would be thrilled by that she didn't know about, which is after she died, the Scripps Research Institute, the Oceanographic in La Jolla, connected to UCSD, has named a research vessel after her. So people are now on the RV Sally Ride, plying the seas and doing the same research under the water that she was doing up in the skies. And that is really exciting. She also started this thing called EarthCam, so little kids could take their own, manipulate the cameras revolving around the Earth to see what Earth looks like from space. There was a version of it called MoonCam. She had kids working on that. And she just opened up a huge new world for them, and many of these projects will continue.
Well, we're about out of time, but is there anything else you'd like us to know about your friend Sally Ride?
That she was funny and witty and a great pal. We had very giggly, girly evenings together over dinner, even after a long day of talking about orbits and perigees and apogees and what was happening in space. But I think maybe Sally's legacy is best summed up in a cartoon I saw after she died. And it was a little girl, teenage girl, sitting at her computer monitor, looking at the headline that said Sally had died, and her mom is standing behind her. And the teenage girl has her room has got rocket ships and space shuttles and posters and physics textbooks. This is clearly a science kid. And she's looking at the obit, and she is saying to her mom, "What? Are you telling me there was a time when women couldn't be astronauts?" So I think this is a wonderful legacy for Sally, that she and all the other women that have come along have proven women can do anything.
Lynn, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It was lots of fun.
Yes, it's a delight to talk to you. Thank you to Lynn Scherr, former ABC News correspondent and author of Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space, published by Simon & Schuster. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Download podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasting groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPRNews or me at Dave Schlom. Our engineer, who always has the right stuff, is Nolan Ford. He and I remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.